In New Hampshire, a forest fire is raging in the White Mountains. The local tourism agency there says this past Columbus weekend is its peak weekend when an estimated 30,000 people make their pilgrimage to see the fall colors. Then should Black Hawk helicopters be dumping hundreds of gallons of water to try to put out the wildfire? What's the right thing to do? If you let the fires burn, they could jeopardize the economy, jeopardize safety of residents and tourists. Chad Hansen is a research ecologist. He co-founded the John Muir Project in California. He's published scientific papers on forest fires, considering history, trends, ecology, and how animals use burned forests. He co-authored a recent piece in the Washington Post titled, "No, We Can't and Shouldn't Stop Forest Fires." He joins us from Big Bear City, California. Chad, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
And Matthew Kaler is with us. He's executive director of the Wild West Institute. That's an organization looking to protect and restore forests in the Northern Rockies. He's worked on wildfires and public lands logging issues for more than 20 years. Matthew Kaler, by the way, grew up in Elkhart Lake, Wisconsin. He joins us now from Missoula, Montana. Matthew, thanks for joining us.
Good morning, Kate. Thanks for having me.
Well, as we begin, we should clarify our language. We are talking about forest fires. Chad, what's the difference between a wildfire and a forest fire?
Well, a forest fire is just a type of wildland fire. There are wildland fires that are in grasslands or shrublands as well. And so, when we hear about forest fires, it's really just a subset of the total.
Okay. Matthew, current forest fires, they're burning across the country. Dozens of active fires are spreading in New Hampshire, Arizona. We've been hearing Napa Valley this morning, Dakotas, Montana, Utah, Oregon, New Mexico. Are fires taking over the land? Is the country burning?
Well, the country is burning, and a lot of the country is predisposed to burn. These are fire-adapted ecosystems. The truth of the matter is, even though there's been a lot of attention on wildfires the past few years, we still are seeing much less acreage burn on an annual basis than we saw even as recently as 80 or 90 years ago. This year, about 10 million acres has burned nationwide, and in the 20s and 30s, we were seeing 30 and 40 million acres burn on average.
Chad, why should we let these fires burn?
Well, that's really the key question, and I think there's two main answers to that. Number one is that these, as Matthew said, these are fire-adapted ecosystems. They evolved with fire, and in fact, there are hundreds of plant and animal species that depend on fire to create the kind of habitat that they need to survive. And so in order to have healthy ecosystems and wildlife populations, we have to have fire. I think that's the first thing, and I'll talk more about that as we go on, but I think the second thing is that we can't stop fires, and we shouldn't try to stop them because it's futile. Once fires are driven by weather and they're moving along, you cannot stop them. They really slow and stop when the weather changes. When you get cool, wet conditions that start again, then those fires, they slow and they stop. But we really don't stop weather-driven fires. We never have. So it really is not beneficial ecologically to try to stop fires, and it's also just risks firefighters' lives unnecessarily and wastes enormous amounts of money trying to stop them when you've got these weather-driven fires in backcountry areas. Instead, we should focus our resources on protecting communities, which we know we can do effectively by basically using fire-resistant materials for roofing and siding and helping people do defensible space work, which is basically just, within about 60 or 100 feet of the homes, removing the smaller trees and the lower limbs on the big trees, and basically just creating more sort of a fire-safe zone around homes.
Oh, so reducing the amount of fuel that there might be to keep a fire going.
Exactly. And really what the science has told us is that the only effective way to protect homes is to do that sort of a zone within about 100 feet. This idea that somehow stopping, trying to suppress backcountry fires or doing these logging projects in these backcountry forests, that's going to protect homes, that's just a fallacy. The science is telling us that you really need to bring those resources right into the homes and the communities themselves, and that's where we can help people. Well, you know, simultaneously, we let fire do the important and, frankly, beneficial ecological work that it's doing out in our, you know, wild forests.
Well, you say weather, I think climate change. Nicola Jones writes a Yale Environment 360 article just last week saying fires are more frequent, more intense. Jones also says the fire season is longer due to climate change. Matthew, what's your take?
Well, my take is that there's definitely some truth in all that. We are definitely experiencing climate change. I'm sure Chad and I would both agree that humans are a major reason we're experiencing human-caused climate change. But, you know, it's also important to realize the other things that humans are doing. 60% of all new home construction in the U.S. since 1990 has occurred in this wildland-urban interface. We're essentially, whether it's out west or in the Great Lakes region, we're essentially gobbling up the countryside and continuing to do that. And, you know, climate change is having an impact. I know Chad has done some research that really is proving that these fires aren't any more catastrophic or intense than they used to be. We're seeing a lot of low-intensity burns, a lot of unburned areas within these fire perimeters, just like we always have.
Matthew, what about logging? How does logging impact these wildfires, forest fires?
Well, I think there's a, you know, really when we talk wildfires out in the West, we're really talking a lot about public lands and public lands management. You know, the logging out West, pretty much any private lands have already been very heavily logged. We've either in the past 150 years put towns and settlements into the areas that were more in the valley bottoms, or we've certainly logged all the big, easy, accessible trees, just like they did in Wisconsin when they basically decimated the white pine forest in a matter of 20 or 30 years. So the timber industry, they're very active politically out here still. They really want to still continue to log the large fire-resistant trees. They're really not that interested in doing more of the home ignition zone work that Chad was talking about, which is more this defensible space work immediately around homes and communities. They still want to go out, and right now in the Northern Rockies, they're logging endangered species habitat. They're building new roads and temporary roads to log in previously unlogged areas. This is all on public lands. And the science is pretty clear that we're not going to log our way to forest health out here, and we're not going to log our way to fireproof these forests or even reduce the intensity or severity of these wildfires.
We're talking right now with Matthew Kaler. He's executive director of the Wild West Institute. That's an organization looking to protect and restore the forests in the Northern Rockies. He's worked on wildfire and public land logging issues for more than 20 years. And we also have on the line Chad Hansen. He's a research ecologist. He co-founded the John Muir Project in California in 1996, and he recently co-authored a piece in the Washington Post called No, We Can't and Shouldn't Stop Forest Fires. You can weigh in on this discussion, 800-642-1234. Can we prevent forest fires? Should we? How do we decide when to battle wildfires and when to let them burn? Have you fought a wildfire? Have you ever had to has fire ever encroached on your land? What was that like? What was your experience? 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Chad, I want to throw this out there. People want to live in beautiful places. They want to live in these forests and have perhaps a beautiful home in a secluded area with the forest all around them. These fires make that a little bit more difficult, do they not?
They do. They do in some ways. I think what they do is they require us to think about fire in our forest differently and how we live in the forest differently. In the past, we thought about fire as this issue that was out there somewhere over the ridge. And, you know, if you stop the fires, they won't come and burn the town. I think that idea has been completely replaced by a notion that we know that fires are going to burn. We know they have to burn. We know in order to have healthy forests, they need to burn. And we know that we can protect homes by doing this defensible space work and doing simple things like replacing that old, cedar shake roof, that wood roof, with a metal roof. Simple things like that, putting rain gutter guards on so leaves and pine needles don't accumulate in the rain gutters, so that a flaming ember doesn't float and land in that and burn the house down. Things like that make the difference between homes burning or not. And that really is the critical difference. So I think what we're coming to realize now is that we don't have a fire problem in the forest. What we have is a human safety and building problem. And it's a fixable thing. I mean, we really can. As Matthew said, we can do a lot through zoning, and we can do a lot through new building materials, and also just by requiring defensible space. Just one example, the La Tuna fire in Los Angeles this year, you had over 700 properties, 700 homes in the fire perimeter, only 4 burned. And that's because there's a strict requirement that defensible space work be done. If this is done properly, over 95% of homes will survive a fire. Fire will burn right through and keep going the other side and won't burn the house down.
But the homeowners or even regulations have to be stepped up and enforced?
Yes, that's right. Well, in many cases, there are no requirements. In many parts of the West and many parts of the country. And it's not just the West, of course. The forests of the upper Midwest and the forests of the eastern U.S., the Appalachians, these are all fire-adapted ecosystems, the Ozarks. And so these issues happen all across the country. And so, we need to have a national conversation about this, not just at the state level and the local level. We need to have a national conversation about basically redirecting our resources, because right now most of the federal resources are being spent trying to stop backcountry fires through these backcountry fire suppression and logging operations, which are just wasting a lot of money and doing a lot of ecological damage. And at the same time, what they're doing is they're diverting scarce resources away from true home protection. And that's really a shame. And so I think what the science is telling us that there's a better way forward.
And U.S. Secretary of the Interior Ryan Zinke says the administration is going to actively prevent forest fires with aggressive methods. He talks about reducing fuel in the forests. What's the argument that logging helps the nation's forest? Is this accurate, Matthew?
Well, I think it's part of what the GOP and Secretary Zinke and President Trump would like people to think, as well as the timber industry. And I guess there's some common sense. I think for a lot of people, they think, well, we have forest fires, so we must have too many trees. And if we just go out and cut some trees, we won't have forest fires. But again, these are complex ecosystems. It's a huge landscapes out here in the West. Just Montana, we have 30 million acres of public lands. And we have huge expanses of private lands out here. What logging does is it's really removing the least flammable part of the tree, the trunk. And what logging leaves behind a lot of times is what does burn and what does fan the flames, and that's logging slash and tree limbs and stuff like that. Logging also, it opens up the forest. It makes the forest hotter, drier, and windier. And, when we have a summer like we did here in the Northern Rockies, where we had, just like a lot of the country, this is a broken record because we're breaking records every year, but we had the hottest summer on record in the Northern Rockies. In Missoula, Montana, we went almost 2.5 months without any measurable precipitation at all. But we had a number of dry lightning storms come through. We also had a very wet winter, a lot of snowpack. So what happened in spring and early summer is we grew a lot of fine fuels. A lot of grasses that might have only been a foot tall were now 3-4 feet tall. And then once the water turned off and we got no more precipitation, and it was in the 90s to low 100s here, even in the Northern Rockies, things dried out. And when we had the fires happening in August, the Forest Service was measuring fuel moisture content in the forest that they had never, it was unprecedented. They had never seen it so dry. So, once you get some lightning strikes and you get 30, 40 mile an hour winds, That's when you're going to see these fires take off, and that's exactly what we did see this year. Now, we're starting to get some new information from the Forest Service on how these fires burned in terms of soils. And a lot of encouraging information is coming out. We're seeing that a lot of these fires in the Northern Rockies here in Montana, even the forest fires, the soils were not severely burned. Most of these fires, the vast majority, 75-80% of the fire area, the soils were either unburned or burned at a very low to low intensity. So again, if fire is a natural beneficial part of these ecosystems, and we're seeing natural fires burn in these areas, we can't stop these fires. And, you know, the fire ecologists are saying we need more fire on the landscape. One of the main fire researchers for the Forest Service, a gentleman named Mark Finney here in Missoula, Montana, says we need five times more fire annually than we're seeing. So, part of the issue is, yes, we need to continue to educate homeowners and communities about what they can do in that home ignition zone. It's not just the vegetation that they have and what their roof is made out of, but what's their patio furniture made out of? What's their decking look like? And we need to really make sure that that home ignition zone is clear and people are prepared for fire, because whether it's next year or 5 years down the road, fire is going to come into these fire-adapted ecosystems, and it's going to try and make its way into these communities, but we can defend them. But the timber industry, again, they're not interested in that. They're interested in going 5-10 miles away from the community, building new roads, and doing logging in native forests that are home to endangered and threatened species such as lynx and grizzly bear and bull trout.
Up to this point in the year, nearly 48,000 wildfires have burned 8 million acres nationwide, with the majority of the wildfire activity in the states of California and Montana. Chances are we've smelled the smoke from as far away as Wisconsin. And this hour, we're looking at whether fire suppression is the answer with our guests. Chad Hansen is a research ecologist. He's co-founder of the John Muir Project in California. And we've been talking with Matthew Kaler, who's executive director of the Wild West Institute, an organization looking to protect and restore forests in the Northern Rockies. You can join in the conversation about forest fires at 800-642-1234. Back after this break here on the Ideas Network. High-profile fires in Yosemite and Glacier National Parks have caught our attention recently. This morning, multiple wildfires are burning early in the day in Sonoma and Napa counties, threatening homes and prompting mass evacuations, as well as school cancellations and power outages. Across the country, millions of acres of forest and grassland fires have burned in recent months, where we've no doubt heard of catastrophic wildfires, but are they really catastrophic? Is this the natural course of nature? Two scientists stay with us. Chad Hansen is a research ecologist, co-founder of the John Muir Project in California, and Matthew Kaler is executive director of the Wild West Institute, an organization looking to protect and restore forests in the Northern Rockies. Let's take a call now with Gary in Boscobel. Hi, Gary.
Thank you for taking my call. I'd like to compliment both of your guests on their thorough knowledge of fire and fire ecology. I work here in Wisconsin as a volunteer founding a nonprofit organization that does prairie restoration. And we are absolutely totally dependent on fire as one of the most important management tools for preserving and restoring the tiny 0.1% of our tall grass prairie that's left. These fires are crucial to suppress brush, and which causes detrimental shading, and they're also crucial for fighting invasive species. A lot of invasive species don't do well under annual burning or biannual burning. The fires for our prairie conservation are crucial also because they tend to recycle nutrients that are tied up in dead vegetation, and they also allow soil temperatures to rise earlier in the growing season because of the dark surface. That allows prairie plants to get an early start at their growing season and outcompete weeds and invasive species.
And Gary,
it also promotes the seed production of these prairie plants. So it's absolutely crucial for us to use fire for one of our management tools.
Gary, I know you wanted to bring up the DNR, the Department of Natural Resources. What would you?
Yes.
Yeah, go ahead on that quick.
Well, the Bureau of Forestry and within the Bureau of Forestry, the fire control people are really pushing to stop all burning on state properties to really put a lid on the use of fire and for management. And here in southern Wisconsin, the oak forests are converting to other species of low-quality hardwoods due to invasive species invasion and also lack of fire. Fire is crucial for a lot of these trees to produce seed or to stimulate the seed production on these, especially oak trees that are fire-dependent. So our southern hardwood forests, especially our oak forests, are really being damaged beyond what could ever be imagined. And all the species that, from plant species, insect species, and animal species that are dependent on these oak-dominated forests are beginning to suffer the consequences because of this lack of this crucial element of fire on the landscape, in the forest, and on the prairies.
Chad, I want you to be able to jump in here. Gary is seeing a change of the trees, low-quality hardwoods.
Yeah, absolutely. We have to have fire in fire-adapted ecosystems in order to maintain the species that live there. You know, in forests, many of the tree species actually depend on fire, and especially intense fire, to actually reproduce. You know, in a number of tree species have what we call serotonous cones, and that means that they evolved with these very, very thick resins in the cones. And you need intense fire to melt the resins and release the seeds so those trees can reproduce. A number of species are like that. Rocky Mountain lodgepole pine is serotonous. Giant sequoias are serotonous. Coulter pines, knobcone pines, many species are like that. And other species have other ways that they depend on fire in order to reproduce effectively. The oaks are another one that in various parts of the country really need fire, and especially more intense fire in places, in order to kill enough of the conifers around them that the oaks get enough sunlight to actually thrive. And once you haven't had fire in a long time, those oaks start to die back. And you can actually lose species from the forest if you don't have fire. And it's not just the plants, of course, it's the animals. You know, many woodpecker species depend on fire because there are native beetle species called wood-boring beetles that have evolved to depend on fire-killed trees. And they lay their eggs on the bark of a fire-killed tree, and the larvae bore into the wood, and the woodpeckers eat those larvae. And they've been doing this for millions of years. And
it's
so,
delicate balance.
Say again?
It's a delicate balance.
It is, and they create nest cavities in the dead trees because they're softer than live trees. And so, you know, those woodpeckers create two or three, sometimes four nest cavities in a given year, and all the ones that they don't use are available for bluebirds and nuthatches and flying squirrels and all kinds of species in the forest that need nest cavities but can't make their own. And, you know, none of that's possible without fire-killing trees and the beetles that these native beetles that depend on fire-killed trees and the woodpeckers that eat them. So, you know, it's a very interconnected system.
Gary, thanks for that call. Let's now go to John in Minneapolis. Go ahead, John.
I just want to say that they're spraying these chemicals in the air like aluminum oxide and barium, and it's causing the vegetation. The trees can't absorb the water when it's got aluminum in them, so it's killing off the trees, and it's causing they become tender boxes.
Matthew, what do we know about the fire suppression chemicals?
Well, we know that they're nasty, that's for sure, and we know that the effectiveness of them is always questioned. They're also very expensive to use. You know, whenever there's a wildfire, it seems like people always like an air show because then it seems like humans are doing something to stop the fire. So we spend a tremendous amount of money on these air tankers dropping toxic chemicals out into the forest. Sometimes they make it into the creeks and the rivers. And you know, at the end of the day, they don't have much of an impact on stopping the fire. What we saw here in the Northern Rockies this year is basically right around mid-September, the weather completely changed. We got a much different jet stream here in the Northern Rockies, a cool, wet jet stream, and literally in a matter of a week, the nature put the fires out.
Let's take another call now. Janet in Warren, Illinois. Go ahead, Janet.
Hi, good morning. This is Jeanette, and I've been in the biology field for 30 years. I spent about 15 years in the West, and I have seen the benefits of fires, and I did participate in cutting and thinning some of the small trees when I worked out at Bryce Canyon. And back here, as a driftless native, my husband's a beekeeper, and we plant prairie, but folks might also need to realize that the prairies are what built our fantastic soil. So even those who don't really care about fire and ecology, they might realize that having the huge amount of biomass in our soil is partly what makes it so great. And that regenerating our habitats with fire and thinning is critical, because we are losing a lot of ground in our oak savannas in this region and our prairies to invasive species.
Jeanette, thank you so much for calling in. Chad, how does fire impact soil? Can you tell us about that correlation?
Sure. Yeah, we hear a lot of sort of mythology about fires in western forests burning so hot that they sterilize the soil. Yeah, that's absolutely not true. You know, I've been working doing my research on the ground in these fire areas for the last 15-plus years, and I've never once seen an area where the soil was sterilized and nothing would grow. What fire really does, including where it burns hot and kills most or all the trees, those patches of high-intensity fire, what it does is actually takes those nutrients that are locked up in branches and twigs and pine needles and leaves on the forest floor, and it turns those nutrients into usable material that the regrowing forest can use to actually regenerate and then the surviving trees to grow faster. And so what it actually does is it spurs production. It makes the forest more vigorous. And in fact, it facilitates the germination of a lot of plants, including a lot of flowering plants, not just trees. And so what you get is this incredibly rich, vibrant ecosystem that starts to develop the first spring after the fire. But, you know, if you come into these areas just after the smoke is cleared, you know, it will look kind of barren in some of the places where it burns hotter. And unfortunately, that's when most of the media attention is on fires. And people think, well, it's going to stay like that. But you just wait till, you know, April or May of the next year, and all of a sudden you've got this incredible, you know, field of wildflowers, and you've got these conifer seedlings and oak sprouts and shrubs, and you know, you've got this, you know, very, very rich, colorful ecosystem.
I want to just piggyback off of that comment. You know, we see the red and the orange flames on television and the crackling of the fire on the radio. Matthew, you view this not as an assault on the nation's forests, but as woodlands healing. Do we have a misperception about fire here?
Yeah, I think humans do have a misperception about fire. I think it's fairly ingrained in our psyche, probably from way, way back. But then, you know, also the Bambi movie and Smokey Bear.
Yep.
And sort of this concept that fire is bad and that fire destroys and kills wildlife and that, you know, you can prevent fire. And yes, humans can prevent wildfire. And, you know, while we're talking about humans and wildfire, we should probably mention that 85% of all wildfires in the U.S. are caused by humans. Another way to maybe deal with this issue is a little more human responsibility. But, you know, when a TV station is going to come and film a wildfire to put it on the 6 or 10 o'clock news, they're not going to show the flames barely lapping on the forest floor and a real cool burning fire. They're going to show, and maybe it was only a 5-minute part of when they were out in the woods for 2 hours, but they're going to show the flames up in the trees, up in the canopy and torching, because, you know, that's the way some of the news media portrays this. And I do think that a lot of humans still are have an innate fear of fire. But again, these are fire-dependent ecosystems, and I'm so glad that some of your local callers, Gary and Jeanette, called in and really spoke up about the tall grass prairies and the oak savannas, because this isn't just a Western issue, and it's not just a forest issue, because these prairie ecosystems are very fire dependent as well. So if we are going to continue to suppress and prevent fire in these areas, we're going to really compromise the ecosystem long term.
Let's take another call now at 800-642-1234. Gary in the town of Ween. Go ahead, Gary.
Well, thank you for another excellent program, and your guests are just excellent. I've just returned from 3 weeks in northern Montana, up in Kootenay and Lolo National Forest and in Glacier. And your guest from Missoula was right on. On the 13th of September, I was driving out, met friends along the Missouri River in North Dakota, and you could smell the smoke, the red sun, hazy sky. By the time we made it into Montana, the next day it was rain. We got to friends who live in Anaconda, and I talked to them on Sunday night, and we're determining where to camp and hike, depending upon where the fires were. It was 85 that night in Anaconda. We got there on Friday. They had 8 inches of fresh snow and 12 inches out at Lost Falls State Park. So that weather system did move in. But I always buy papers as I travel, and I like the Missoulian. It had some good articles, but on the September 19th issue in their opinion page had a letter by a Julia Altimus from the Montana Wood Products Association, and she's a little bit, her science is a little bit shaky, which fits in with our governments in Wisconsin and the United States these days. But a different article I'd read said the fire season in Montana is now 78 days longer than it was in the 1970s. And this was written, I don't know if the person wrote it was at the University of Montana in Missoula or where, but I just remember the article and talked about the lower levels of moisture in the woods.
Let's let Matthew respond here. Is the fire season almost 3 months longer from what it used to be?
Excellent points, Gary. And yes, I know Julia Altimus and her opinions on this well, but that we'll have to save for another show. The fire season is about 75 days longer on half of that on the front side and half of it on the back side, basically pushing into spring and summer a little bit more. That's not just for Montana, but that's Western wide. Ironically, they found that the human caused fires, which again account for 85% of all fire starts in the U.S., that human-caused fires have pushed the fire season longer, even to a greater extent than climate change has. Climate change has definitely changed the weather patterns out here. We're breaking records for record drought and record heat, it seems like, every month and every year. And, when you have these fire dependent ecosystems and you get some of these dry lightning storms that come through and these high winds and 100 degree temperatures. And, a lot of people in the Midwest think Montana, it's all forested and it must be wet out there. But that's opposite. Our valleys in the West, in Western Montana, get about 12 or 13 inches of precip on average per year. And, when these fires were burning this summer, we had temperatures in the 90s, and our relative humidity is under 10%. So when you get 30 and 40 mile an hour wind gust, really all you can do is get out of the way and wait for the weather to change. And that's exactly what happened this year.
Dozens of wildfires are burning across the country, and lawmakers in Washington have called for stepped-up logging to help reduce forest fires. We're looking at the ramifications of thinning woodlands, trying to regulate when and where fires burn, looking at climate change, how it factors in, with Chad Hansen, a research ecologist. He's co-founder of the John Muir Project in California. And Matthew Kaler, joining us from Missoula, Montana, head of the Wild West Institute in Montana. Your thoughts on this as well, 800-642-1234. Should we allow these fires to burn? Should we be doing more to put them out? Why and how? And do you think logging helps the health of a forest? Or do you think we should preserve natural processes? Join in 800-642-1234. Post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Back after this short break. Forest fires are natural, but the number and extent of the fires being seen today are not. These fires are man-made, or at least man-worsened. That's a quote from a new article published by the Yale School of Forestry and Environmental Studies. It goes on to say that the increase in forest fires is directly linked to climate change. And as the world continues to warm, there will be greater risk for fires on nearly every continent. We're unpacking this and views on forest fires with two scientists. Chad Hansen is a research ecologist. He's co-founder of the John Muir Project in California. And Matthew Kaler is head of the Wild West Institute in Montana. You can join us with your questions and thoughts on the wildfires at 800-642-1234. Let's go to Kurt in Chippewa Falls. Go ahead, Kurt.
Yes, good morning. Along with everything else, everything seems to be politicized nowadays. Is the demand or the need to protect houses, or the homes in these heavily forested areas, is that a major contributing factor to the effort to put out these fires, to suppress them at the huge public expense to protect private residences?
Chad?
It's an argument that's being made, but that's not actually what the federal land management agencies are doing. And this is a critical point, because oftentimes they'll say, well, we're trying to suppress these fires, or we're doing these logging operations to try to protect homes. But these logging operations and most of the fire suppression is happening in backcountry forests, miles away from the nearest home, miles away from the nearest town. And this is what, you know, the Trump administration right now and the Republican leadership in Congress right now is promoting. They're promoting bills that would roll back environmental laws, basically largely eliminate 40 years of public lands law to massively increase logging operations on our national forests under the guise of fire management and curbing wildland fires. But the reality is that's just going to divert more scarce resources away from true home protection, and it's just going to damage forests. You know, we did the largest study ever on this last year, 1,500 fires over 30 years in the western United States, and we found that the forests with the least environmental protections and the most logging actually burned the most intensely. So the entire premise of these logging bills is contradicted by the science.
Wait, you're saying the forests with the least environmental protections had the greatest amount of fires?
Had the most intense fire, right. And the forests with the most protections and the least logging or no logging at all had the least intense fire. And they still had a nice mix of fire intensities, and you need that. You need areas that burn at low, moderate, and high-intensity fire, because there's different species, wildlife species, that depend on those different types. But the point is that where you had that least intense mix was actually in the most protected forest. So, you know, the solution here is to focus our resources on protecting communities. Allow fire to do its important work in our wildlands, because the fact is that we do not have too much fire. We have less fire now than we had naturally before fire suppression policies, because, you know, a lot of fires are put out when they can be put out, which is during a lightning strike during a summer rainstorm when the fire is barely moving. And fires can be put out in those conditions. But once they get going and are moving under high fire weather, or whether there's a lightning strike during a dry lightning strike during hot, dry, windy conditions, those fires cannot be stopped. And they, you know, we shouldn't even try, because it's not possible. It really is important. You know, you mentioned the Yale School of Forestry article. That's misleading on a number of levels. You know, we really do not have, there's a broad consensus among scientists that we have a deficit of fire in western forests, and in fact, in eastern forests as well. We have less than we had naturally. And so you know, it's really important to keep that in mind. And in fact, fires are not getting more intense in western forests. We do not have more intense fires. In other words, the proportion that burns at high intensity, where you have crown fire, that proportion has not been increasing, despite the fact that we have more fire now than we had in the 1970s, and we do have a longer fire season. But interestingly, fires are not getting more intense, and so that's an important thing to keep in mind, is that that's really not the case. And in fact, the largest fires that we have are still burning mostly at low and moderate intensity. So they're not burning in these unnaturally severe ways. The main problem is we just don't have enough fire in our fire-adapted ecosystems, whether it's forests or grasslands or most other places. There are a couple exceptions to that, like chaparral in Southern California that actually has too much fire. But most places, we have too little.
Kurt, thank you so much for calling in. Let's take another call now. John in Helena, Montana. Go ahead, John.
Hi, thanks for the great show. I'd like to ask your guests what their thoughts are on politicians who I hear and read about in the newspaper blaming environmentalists for fires, while at the same time these politicians refuse to take any actions to curb climate change or, in fact, even bend over backwards to promote the fossil fuel industry and Congress and state governments.
Well, let's start in Montana there with Matthew. Go ahead, Matthew.
Yeah, that's a great question and something that we deal with both this year and it seems like for the past 20 years here in Montana. Every summer, we have wildfires, and every summer, politicians, really from both parties, but certainly more Republican-leaning politicians, they blame these wildfires on environmentalists. In fact, earlier this year, Secretary Ryan Zinke flew out in an airplane. I believe it was a chartered military plane, which has also been in the news. But he flew out with Secretary of Agriculture Sonny Perdue and our Senator Steve Daines and our Congressman Greg Gianforte, who people might remember the night before his election, he actually body slammed and assaulted a reporter and was found guilty for that. But these folks came out to the Lolo Peak fire here just south of Missoula, Montana, in an area, it's part of the Lolo in the Bitterroot National Forest. There hadn't been a lawsuit against a logging project in that part of the forest for 25 years. It was a lightning-caused fire. And they came out here and they blamed the wildfires on, quote, environmental extremists, radicals. One of my favorite ones is fringe. What did they call it? Fringe elements in our community are responsible for these fires. So really just, fanning the flames of hatred towards environmentalists.
No pun intended.
No pun intended. And, with no basis whatsoever, more logging will not stop these fires, and how environmentalists are responsible for a fire burning in a place that environmentalists haven't stopped any logging in 25 or 30 years is unknown to me, how that all matches up in their logic. But, we see that every year, and we see it continuing to happen. And thankfully, what we've seen here in Montana is a lot more of the scientists and the researchers at places like the University of Montana, which has an excellent School of Forestry, and also a number of leading fire ecologists. They're really speaking up and taking these politicians to task, because as the caller pointed out from Helena, it's very ironic that the same politicians that when the coal companies come into their office or the oil and gas companies come into their office, they put out their hand and they get tens of thousands of dollars put into their hands by these resource extraction companies. These politicians do nothing to curb climate change. They do nothing to wean us off these fossil fuels. Honestly, they do nothing really. What are the main issues facing public lands management out here in the West? Well, we have a $10 billion backlog of road maintenance and watershed maintenance. We have a $500 million backlog of trail maintenance. And yet the politicians want to continue to undermine our nation's bedrock environmental laws, the Endangered Species Act,
and I want
all
to let,
to try and get more logging done.
I want to let Chad jump in here. Chad, if we stripped out all of the interests, the tourism, the economic interests, the logging interests, How could legislation, how could politicians shape this to help the forests to do more?
Really, the answer is ecologically and economically, we really need to protect our forests, because the fact is that we have the most natural fire regimes in protected forests. Logging, just as Matthew said earlier, it just removes the basically non-combustible material, which is tree trunks, and leaves behind the most combustible material, which is branches and treetops. It's like a campfire. Anyone who's ever built a campfire, you know, you start the fire with kindling. You don't put a big log on the fire, put a match to it, and expect it to burn. Same thing works in forest fires. And so, you know, the entire premise of their argument is just baseless. And, you know, what we know is that protected forests have the most vibrant and vigorous levels of wildlife and biodiversity. They have very healthy and natural fire regimes. And in fact, communities and counties that have the most protected public lands actually have, on average, higher incomes, have higher employment rates. And in fact, you know, the recreation economy is really the big driver in rural economies these days, where communities have realized that the kind of boom and bust cycle of resource extraction has not been that helpful. On public lands, for example, recreation and tourism provides 31 times more jobs than logging on national forests. And, you know, from a climate standpoint, protecting forests sequesters and stores enormous amounts of carbon because, you know, forests basically breathe in carbon dioxide. And when you log those forests, enormous amounts of carbon is released. And so, you know, if we protect our national forests from logging, it would be the equivalent of removing 13 to 24 million cars off the road.
So as we wrap up and each having the last word here, you can each weigh in very quickly. How should Americans protect their safety, defend their property, while also taking care of our forests? Chad?
Well, we really need to protect our national forests from logging. We need national legislation to stop logging on national forests and redirect the money that's currently being spent on these destructive backcountry logging projects and on unnecessary backcountry fire suppression. Redirect that instead to help people protect their homes through defensible space and more fire-resistant home building materials. That is proven to be effective. We know it works. There's lots of science on it. At least 95% of homes will survive fires if this is done properly. But right now, that's not where the money's being spent. And, you know, if these bills in Congress right now that the Trump administration is promoting, if they pass, they're just going to double down on the mistakes of the past.
And Matthew, very quickly.
Yeah, I would agree with all that. Homeowners need to, right now, not next summer when it's fire season, but right now, homeowners need to take responsibility to establish defensible space. There's a lot of information online. They can go to firewise.org and learn how to take some real common sense measures in that home protection zone. And then I'd encourage everybody to be active and let your federal elected officials, your senators and your congressperson, know how you feel about these issues. Public lands are very important to all of us. You know, we like to hike, we like to hunt and fish in those areas. They're very important for wildlife and obviously the environment. And we need to make sure that we're not using these wildfires as an excuse to really just pass a timber industry and resource extraction wish list that is to gut all these bedrock.
And I'm going to have to stop you there. Matthew Kaler, head of the Wild West Institute, reached him in Missoula, as well as Chad Hansen, who co-founded the John Muir Project.